step over the threshold of childhood and into whatever was waiting for her on the other side. My hands still in my pockets, I want to reach out for Jane's shoulder. I don't. But maybe some invisible part of me does, like a phantom limb, because she turns around anyway. "Mom," she says, and she buries her head in my shoulder for a second, her arms pinning mine down, almost hurting me. When she pulls away, I've got tears in my eyes, but I let them stand and subside and pull my hands out of my pockets at last, rest one on her elbow. "I love you," I say. Her face is serious and a little sad. "Mom," she says, "I think you should know something. Julie has a cell phone. She told me she borrowed one to call me yesterday, but then I saw it in her purse." She reaches into her pocket and pulls out a slip of paper. I wrote the number down. She gently takes my hand away from her elbow, and the last bit of Jane I feel is her fingers pressing the paper into my palm. Then she's gone. The car growls down the driveway, and I stand there a bit too long before putting the paper in my pocket, still feeling Jane's touch and wondering absently why she has a white bandage around one of her fingers. When I turn, Julie is standing by the kitchen island looking at me. I wonder how long she's been there, what she heard, and what she saw. Star learned how to lie at the Black Rose in Portland, Oregon. Not that she'd never lied before, to police officers, to foster parents, to anyone who looked like he or she might use the truth to hurt her. But those were lies she told with words, and anyone who was really paying attention could see through words. At the Black Rose, she learned to lie with her whole body. She'd washed up in Pioneer Courthouse Square as Mercy with brown shoulder-length under-the-radar hair and walked due east over the river until she was through with walking. She'd passed two other clubs, but the Rose was the first one with a picture on the dingy sign, and the swirls of dark petals surrounded by a spiky halo appealed to her. She didn't even have to take her clothes off to get the job. Just show Gary, a tall, skinny guy with a hipster mustache, proof that she was over 21. He explained that she'd be renting her mandatory stage time with watery $10 drinks the customers bought her, 10 drinks for one stage dance, 20 for two, and so on. If she didn't make her drink quota, she'd be buying the rest herself at the end of the night, out of the cash she made from lap dances and stage dollars, after tipping out the bar, the door, the waitresses, and the security staff. So it would behoove her, Gary said, enjoying the use of the word, to hustle as many drinks off her lap dances as she could. As for rules, well, since deregulation, anything went. No no-touch rule, no 3-foot rule, and nothing had to be covered. He gestured over to one of the armchairs that lined the walls, where a dancer was sitting naked in a customer's lap, her legs open, his fingers sunk inside her up to the third joint. The customer's head leaned back against the wall while the dancer rolled on him absently. "Thank you, Oregon Supreme Court," Gary said, with a smile implied, but not on his face. She didn't have to do that stuff, of course. The point was, she could do just about whatever she wanted. She could light her pubes on fire for all he cared. There was just one thing. "You can't be Mercy. We've got one already." Star's first stage dance was on a Thursday afternoon. Too early, though you couldn't tell what time it was inside the windowless club, where the fog machine churned day and night. She gyrated awkwardly to the music, slithering out of the makeshift girl-next-door costume she'd cobbled together with a stolen G-string from a mall store, and awaited the exposed and endangered feeling. But the closer she got to peeling the G-string down around her ankles, the more clothed she felt. Naked on the stage, save for neon yellow platform heels, she was unassailable, stripped down to armor that could never be taken off. When she got down from the stage and walked among her prey, the feeling faded. They were sad, daytime customers, and since there was a club on every block, it was nothing they hadn't seen before. The newly eviscerated vice laws meant the strippers could use their bodies to wrest money from wallets with brazen aggression. Some of the girls ended every dance lying on their backs, arms pasted to the floor, waving their legs like strange underwater plants around naked genitals elevated to customer face level. Their pussies were as dry as mouths left open too long and as impersonal as rubber chickens, but it didn't matter. Men stood transfixed, peering into the permanent goose flesh as if they could will its transformation into warm, wet intimacy. Star tried the helicopter move at home once, but her abdominal muscles were pathetic. She could barely manage the most basic pole moves, though she was learning from her roommates, most of whom were dancers, too. Gary had pointed her toward the dilapidated Victorian off Hawthorne, with half the front steps rotted out and black-taped windows that beaded up and sweated in the never-ending drizzle. She didn't leave anything there. Her backpack full of trophies and her slowly growing collection of outfits were safer in a locker at the Rose. And she wore her only jewelry, the gold chain with the little horse charm around her ankle while she danced. For all she was addicted to the hot lights on her sweaty skin and the bitter taste of the fog machine in the back of her throat, there was no doubt Star was a terrible stage dancer. Her lap dances were more successful. She hated being down on the floor amid the stares and gropes and was distant and sullen. But sullen had its own appeal for some, and she had her customers just like the girls who giggled and flirted had theirs. Enthusiasm was not required so long as she got the script right, and the lines were almost painfully easy to memorize. It didn't matter whether or not they believed her, it was all part of the transaction. She learned which customers to tell it was only her first or second time doing this, which to tell that she was saving money for college or some new toys for her kid. With others, she didn't say anything about herself at all, just made a kind of purring noise, as if she felt lucky to be grinding on their crotches. Still, there were too many strippers and not enough customers. Some of the girls rolled their eyes about the D-reg and bitched that a worse thing had never happened. Some nights, Star barely took home anything after tip-out. Plus, there were a million ways you could slip and fall in the newly permissive atmosphere. A million ways you could ruin everything in the split second between a smile and a nod. She had seen girls followed out back on their cigarette breaks by their favorite customers after an offer to make a little extra money, and then come back that same night with a black eye or a broken strap, or not at all. Star, remembering the Peets, had no interest in these side transactions. But if she said no too many times, she risked losing herself a regular, which meant losing the club a regular, and that wasn't good either. So her job was to say nothing at all, to communicate neither yes nor no, but keep looking as if she might say yes someday, as if she were just waiting for the right moment. It was an education in disappearing. Graduation came when another dancer handed her a plastic tub half full of Manic Panic hair dye in an unmissable shade of red and said, "Trust me, it'll show up under the lights." Advice of this nature didn't come often, so Star took it and found that being brighter on the outside meant, paradoxically, making an even darker hiding place for herself on the inside. Over the next 8 months, she learned it didn't have to be just hair. It could be an accent, or a strange last name, or a fake tattoo on the back of her neck. It could be bright blue eyeliner, a pair of cowboy boots, or something outlandish she made up on the spot when customers asked where she was from. A farm she had grown up on, a famous ballerina she had studied with. When you looked like she did, with wide cheekbones and smooth white skin and big, blank, Cupid doll eyes, people would accept anything about you but the truth. Whether she told them she'd been a porn star or a prize fighter, they believed her, in a way they'd never believed or cared about her invented baby sister or community college courses. She started making real cash, buying 4 stage dances a night and entertaining tables of a dozen customers or more who came in just for her. Moreover, they bought drinks for any girls she brought over, and that made the other dancers friendly. After one particularly full shift, she and a few other girls went down the street and got matching tattoos of the spiky, haloed rose on the club sign. She didn't know what else she could spend cash on that wouldn't weigh her down. But the other law of being highly visible was you had to leave while the shine was still on. So when a group of women started frequenting the Black Rose during her shifts, Star took note. Lena, short for Carolina, was a 55-year-old El Salvadorian with a short, grizzled mane, a thick neck, and a body that was round and pleasant. Lena came in all the time with her girlfriend Heidi, who looked a bit like Star without her makeup. Then one time, Lena came in without Heidi, and Star, who was ready to quit the club and move out of the Hawthorne house, got the message. She left with Lena at the end of her shift. Lena lived in a huge Victorian in Northeast, so high up it was practically on stilts. A beard of ground cover spilled down over a mossy concrete wall that looked barely adequate to keep the front yard from tumbling into the street. A stone staircase studded with clumps of tiny violets pinched shut in the pre-dawn chill led from sidewalk to front door. Star climbed up first, past gnarled Japanese maples with spidery leaves and bleeding heart bushes whose hot pink blossoms looked frozen in the act of ripping themselves open. The rough steps seemed endless after a long shift, but when Star got to the top, she could see it was going to be worth it. The oval of stained glass in the door was just catching the first rays of sunlight. Lena opened the front door and let Star in. The floor was made of cool, silky wood, covered with a big, soft rug of yellowish-white fur. "Alpaca," Lena said, watching Star's face as she wiggled her toes in the shag. "From home. They're very cheap there. I got that for $300. That didn't sound cheap to Star, but she just said, "It's nice." The ceiling was vaulted over the living room, and there was a large abstract painting hanging on the wall. It looked like fruit dropped from a great height. "Did you paint that?" she asked. "As a matter of fact, I did," Lena said. Her voice toughened up, and she looked around the room casually. "You like it?" "It makes me feel a little dizzy," Star said truthfully. "Can I lie down?" "Of course," said Lena. And she ushered her out of the vaulted living room and into a side room lined with raw wood where there was a tall bed covered by a shimmering reddish-orange comforter. The wooden blinds were drawn, and it was blessedly dark. Without hesitation, Star pulled off her shoes and climbed up on the mattress, which sank under her weight. She slid to the center and flipped over onto her back, exhausted, staring at the motionless ceiling fan of dark wood. She wondered what used to go through Heidi's head when she stared at the ceiling fan. Where had Heidi worked before Lena came along? Had she fallen in love with Lena? "Why don't you tell me your real name? I don't think it's Star." She could feel the tiny beads embroidered on the comforter biting into her spine like the princess in the pea. "Violet," she said, thinking of the purple flowers outside on the steep lawn. It wasn't the most convincing name she'd ever come up with, but she needed something as good as Heidi, who'd surely made up her name too before she'd been extracted as neatly as a tooth so that Star could occupy her dent in the bed. Wouldn't it be easier if she could just use Heidi's name? She imagined herself saying, "Heidi," and Lena saying, "What a coincidence." But the bed was the softest place she'd been in months, and she accidentally said the second part out loud. Just as Lena said, "What is?" Star let go of the ceiling fan with her eyes and fell backward into slumber. 8. As the door closes behind her, the superficial layer of animation Jane brings to the house falls away, and the uneasy secrets Julie and I share swell up to fill the kitchen like a scent. "How are you feeling today?" I ask. "Okay," she says, placing a hand on her stomach. "Like a bad period." I nod, remembering my miscarriage.
"Did you tell Jane?"
She shakes her head. "No, we were having a nice time. I didn't want to make her feel bad."
"You know, you could have called me to pick you up, if you wanted to get out of the house."
She's silent.
"We could have gotten lunch or something, gone shopping."
"More shopping?" she says with a quick laugh. Then she puts on an appreciative face. "I just wanted my sister."
"And now she's gone."
The second half of the statement trails along in its wake like a ghost.
"I'm glad you girls got to spend a little time together. And I'm so sorry for the way I behaved. I just wish we had known where you were."
I'm choosing my words carefully, giving her plenty of space, like she's a deer behind a tree instead of a girl behind a butcher block. "I'm really sorry about that," she says.
I guess I started feeling a little trapped. I can't even think about what that word must mean for her. Hearing her say it is different from when Tom said it last night. It makes me feel trapped, too, suffocated by grief, like she's keeping me in a room with all the lights off. I scramble at the evidence of her lies, the paper folded up in the pocket of my jeans, but I am so afraid of confronting her with it that what I end up saying instead is, "Julie, I think it's time we get you a cell phone." She doesn't blink. I let a beat go by before I continue. "For Tom and me, really, so we can reach you and you can reach us if you need to." Should I have waited a moment longer? Was her mouth opening to tell me the truth when I cut her off? I have one already. It's in my bag. Here's a plausible explanation of how I came to have it, along with my very good reasons for not mentioning it. At any rate, what she says now is, "Thanks, Mom." And I feel a strange relief that I don't yet have to hear the plausible explanation, the very good reasons. She goes on, "Can I ask you something I've been worried about?" "Of course. Maybe it is coming right now, after all." "I'm kind of worried about money." It's so unexpected, so unlike something Jane, for instance, would say, that I just repeat the word blankly. "Money?" "Well, I know I'll have to get a job at some point." "Oh, honey, you don't need to think about..." "But I do need to think about it. I do," she insists. "We haven't talked about what it was like for you guys after it happened, but I know you must have spent a lot of... I mean, I know it's expensive. I've seen the billboards."
"You have?"
"I looked up some stuff about my case on the internet," she says. "Has she been on Tom's computer, or did she use the secret phone?" I know Dad left his job, and Jane's in college."
"Your father does fine, and so do I. We're fine, Julie.
And now I'm here, which is the best and luckiest and most wonderful thing that could ever have happened to us. I know, I just..." She throws up her hands. "I have to figure out what I'm going to do with my life." And then, in a slightly different tone, "I've been applying for jobs, you know." I'm caught off guard.
"What kind of jobs?"
"Oh, anything," she says evasively. "Baristas, cashiers. I even went inside that bar around the corner yesterday, I forget the name, to ask if they needed a dishwasher." It takes me a moment to realize what bar she's talking about. That squalid, sad little bar in the strip center? Billy's or Bobby's or something? She went in there? She's watching my face, hanging on my flickering expressions, so I try to look expectant, like I'm waiting without judgment for her to finish. "I tried Starbucks, too," she goes on quickly. "But I didn't end up applying there. I was too tired and kind of addled, I guess, from the painkillers. That's when I called Jane."
"On a borrowed phone," I add. I can't help it.
"Yeah. I don't know why I didn't call Dad, except I knew Jane had the car and that he would have to walk in the heat to come get me. I didn't want to be too much of a bother. And I was kind of not thinking too straight."
This whole conversation is a lie.
"Anyway, so I wanted to tell you. I feel really bad about this, but I want you to know where I've been." She takes a breath, steeling herself for the big revelation. "For the past few weeks, I haven't been going to therapy."
I brace myself. She's going to tell me everything, and it will make sense. It will make perfect sense.
"I've just been driving around," she says.
And so it's to be another lie after all, I think, and then immediately afterward, I'm not sure.
"I can't bear to think of all that money it's costing, so I just cancel and then I drive around trying to figure out what I'm going to do. If I get a job, like as a waitress or something, I can study for my GED at night, and then maybe I'll go to college, too, someday, like Jane." She looks up on that last phrase with an absurd kind of hope, daring me to disbelieve the emotion underneath those words. It works. The thought of all the opportunities Jane's had, all the opportunities Julie missed out on and that can never be made up, is paralyzing. My head hurts from trying to separate what's real from what's not. "I'm glad you're thinking about your future,"
I manage. I mean, I want those things for you too, if that's what you want, but for now, you have to see a therapist. Someone else, if you don't like her, money doesn't come into it. We'll be fine. We'll manage.
You've spent so much on me already, she presses on. All those clothes, new furniture, and now a phone. And if I ever do catch up enough to get into college, I don't know what college costs, but I doubt there are special scholarships for kidnapped girls.
The word scholarship makes me think of something. The Julie Fund, I say.
What's that?
She asks. The public donation fund in your name. It's how we paid for the billboards and the reward money and everything else.
We did?
Tom, the accountant, did. He handled everything while I... Who knows what I was doing? I can barely remember the days, weeks, months. There was a sum put aside for ransom. We were going to use it to set up a scholarship in your name if... I can't finish.
Can't we use it now? She says. I mean, I'm back.
It doesn't work like that, I say, groping through hazy memories for the details. There are restrictions to what public donations can be used for, and somebody who's not in the family has to be in charge of it. Tom and I can't even make a withdrawal without getting in touch with the fund administrator. Just as I realize I don't know the answer to the next question she's going to ask, she asks it.
Who's the fund administrator?
Oh, I'd have to find out from your dad, I reply lamely. But you're the sole beneficiary. I look up and realize she's staring at me. I can almost see the next words forming on her lips, so before she can ask, I say, somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000. She doesn't even try to conceal how much larger the number is than she was expecting.
Wow,
she says. And then tears start wobbling in her blue eyes. Her chin shakes.
You must have really wanted to find me.
It's only after she goes upstairs to take a bath, and I hear her sobs coming from the bathroom, that I wonder how she could have read enough to find out about the billboards without coming across anything about the Julie Fund. The new girl was thinking about her next name as she watched Mercedes gather the sheet taut with one hand, lift the mattress corner with the other, flip up a folded white triangle, smooth the crease, and tuck it in. Before she could catch the trick of the fold, Mercedes had already finished and moved over to her side of the bed. It took the more experienced woman 15 seconds to pull out the new girl's lousy attempt at a hospital corner and refold it.
It looks like putting on a diaper, the new girl said.
Mercedes paused what she was doing, scooting on one knee from corner to corner as she tucked in the bottom edge of the sheet and rolled her unusual blue eyes.
Guess you've never done that before either, huh?
The new girl felt herself flush. Later, when they were in the supply closet together, loading the cart with wrapped rolls of toilet paper, Mercedes said,
Maybe you do have a little one.
The girl didn't answer right away.
I shouldn't have assumed.
The new girl shrugged and ran the palm of her hand lightly over the spray tops hooked on the cart, feeling for the empties.
Do you have kids? She asked.
Dos, and that's it for me, Mercedes said, crossing herself with a laugh.
It's all I can handle.
I couldn't even handle one.
You're too young, Mercedes said. Better wait until you're my age.
How old are you?
24.
It did seem old to the new girl, enviably so. She'd gotten a nasty shock when she ran out of bus money in Eugene and found out at the first strip club she tried that you had to be 21 to work there. Her fake IDs were good enough to get her waved into bars, but she knew they'd never survive close inspection in the back office of a club where alcohol was served. Still, she'd given it one shot with Jessica Morgenstern, her 22-year-old Texas blonde blue, at a second club. The guy barely glanced at it under the black light before tossing it back to her.
Try across the parking lot, he said. They hire illegals over there.
She snatched the fake ID back and crossed over to the budget Village Inn and Suites. Maids made tips, didn't they? She wasn't entirely convinced, but the motel staff was overwhelmed that morning because of some college football game.
She hardly had time to think about it, much less drop a fake, before the desk manager, balancing the telephone receiver on one shoulder, shoved a uniform at her across the counter and pointed her toward Mercedes' cart down the hall.
"Just do what she tells you, comprende?"
he said with his hand over the mouthpiece, barely glancing at her. At the back of the motel, a large storage room full of broken furniture culled from the suites hosted a rotating circle of undocumented workers who didn't have family members in town. The young woman with whom she shared a sprung mattress mumbled in her sleep, but at least it was a bed. The work seemed all right, too, at first, and she congratulated herself on her sturdy back and legs, strong from riding horses in Red Bluff. More troubling to her were the crowds of college-age kids and their parents all decked out in green and yellow T-shirts, with duck mascots on them, loud and patronizing and always annoyed when they had to cross over to the other side of the hall to accommodate the squealing housekeeping carts. She stared hardest at the blonde, ponytailed girls. When she entered their rooms, she touched charm bracelets left carelessly on dressers, expensive-looking bottles of hair conditioner in showers, logoed duffels spilling sandals and pink pajamas onto the floor. On the third day, searing pains started up in the new girl's shoulders, lower back, neck, and upper arms. She could barely roll out of the storage room bed, and vacuuming sent shooting pains up through her skull in rhythm with the roar of the machine. That morning, while Mercedes was cleaning a bathroom, the new girl stole a moment to rub her shoulders while the vacuum idled. She spotted a long green and yellow ribbon on the dresser, lifted it up and tied it around her own ponytail, wincing at the burn in her triceps, then stared at herself in the mirror and pursed her lips up in a tight rosebud smile. When she heard the toilet flush, distant and faint behind the vacuum noise, she yanked the ribbon off. Mercedes emerged from the bathroom holding a dwindled roll of toilet paper and exaggeratingly mouthing the word restock. After they finished up in the supply closet, Mercedes said, "I know where you've been sleeping, and girl, you're going to kill your back that way. Come home with me tonight. We have an extra bed since my cousin moved out." The new girl nodded, and Mercedes smiled briefly before wheeling the cart back out to knock on the next door. Home was a second-story apartment, in a red brick apartment block about an hour away by bus, including 15 minutes waiting for a transfer in the misty drizzle. The new girl resented having to pick the bus fare out of her meager tips, but when they climbed the stairs after dark, she could see from the steam on the kitchen window that a meal was waiting. Mercedes opened the door to the warm sounds of television commercials and a running faucet, and the larger of two small boys lying in front of the TV set looked over his shoulder and said, "Hi, Mom," then turned back as a cartoon started. From the kitchen, a woman was already talking to Mercedes in Spanish, running through the events of an exhausting day from the sound of it. Mercedes cut her off, also in Spanish, and gestured toward the new girl, who closed the door behind them and relaxed into the noisy, steamy apartment. The woman who turned from the sink looked about 10 years older than Mercedes, but it was hard to tell under her heavy makeup. "That's my sister Lucia. Sit down," Mercedes commanded, pointing. Then she launched into a fresh round of Spanish directed at her sister, gesturing toward the single plate set on the kitchen table. The woman barely glanced at the new girl, not smiling, and shrugged. Wordlessly, she opened the kitchen cabinet, removed a plate, gathered up silverware from a drawer, and set them all on the low counter that separated kitchen from dining room. Then, grabbing the magazine that had been open in front of her on the counter, she walked out of the kitchen, past the children in the TV room, and into the hall. "Is she okay?" the new girl whispered, as Mercedes moved around the counter into the kitchen and started scooping some chicken and rice out of a pot on the stove onto the plate. "She's fine. She's okay. She watches the kids until I get home. Then she has to go to sleep to get up early to open at the department store." But by the time Mercedes had finished serving up her own plate and brought it to the table, another TV had started up in the back bedroom. Spanish voices clearly audible through the thin walls, clashing with the English-language cartoons. "Eat!" The new girl obeyed. The food was good, and she said so. "It's been a while for home cooking, huh? Lucia's a good cook. She won't let me pick up McDonald's for everyone on the way home. She says the boys have to eat everything fresh." She shuddered over a forkful of chicken. "I couldn't do it with my hours at the motel, but she's going to try to get me hired at the store when she's been there a little while longer."
The new girl felt the warmth of the meal spreading through her. The chicken leg on her plate was so tender the meat fell off the bone with the gentlest prod of her fork. She thought about what it would be like to have a girlfriend, someone to talk things over with while they waited in the kiosk. She imagined them in their uniforms, side by side on the bus, laughing about... what?
It's my turn! No, mine!
The cartoon show's credits were rolling and the boys were struggling for the remote. When one started wailing, Mercedes snapped her head over her shoulder, the smile dropping from her face like a mask.
Boys! She shouted. It's bedtime! I'll be in your room to tuck you in 5 minutes, so start brushing your teeth now!
She looked back at the new girl apologetically. I'll go make sure you've got clean sheets and put the boys to bed.
You'll have more food if you like. Watch TV.
She gestured vaguely, then got up and walked through the TV room, stopping a few times to pick up toys on the floor before vanishing around the corner. As closet doors opened and closed somewhere in the apartment and the two boys squabbled over something...
Give it!
The new girl eyed Mercedes' purse where it lay unzipped on the kitchen counter. One half of her brain was still riding the bus into work the next day, and the other half was adding up her tips, subtracting bus fare, calculating if the rest would cover brown hair dye. There was no need to steal money when all that stood between her and the real earning potential was a little plastic rectangle saying, Mercedes Rodriguez, California, brown hair, blue eyes, 24 years old, lying in an unzipped bag 3 feet away. If the universe was handing out mercy, she'd take it. 9. Tom doesn't come home after eating breakfast with Jane. He doesn't come home for lunch, either. It occurs to me for the first time that Tom has not so much as mentioned the Julie Fund since our daughter's return. Surely he has thought about what we could or should do with the money, whether we should proceed with the scholarship in Julie's name, or if, as Julie hinted, we could convert it into a kind of scholarship for her. Or maybe now that Julie is 21, it's her money, her decision, sole beneficiary. Then what about the trustees, the administrator? Tom has dealt with everyone, even our lawyer, for so long that I find myself completely at a loss as to where to begin. Tom's desk is in the room where Julie lies sleeping. I gave her a Valium after she got out of the bathtub, and she swallowed it with her skin still steaming, slipped under the covers, bathrobe and all, and closed her swollen eyes immediately. Now I walk down the hall, and after listening for a moment to her gentle wheezing from just outside the door, nudge it open. She hasn't moved, not even to roll over. The covers are still where I placed them, her red hair sticking out in strange directions, the way short hair does when you go to bed with it wet. I can just see a faint pinkish shadow seeping out from under her head on the pillow. I turn my back to her and sit down at Tom's desk, conscious of the magnified squeak of the office chair, the brittle sound of its wheels rolling over the plastic carpet protector. At one point, I jerk around, positive I heard Julie stir, but she's still lying motionless, facing away from the desk. Tom's desk is almost antiseptically organized. Writing tools neatly ensconced in sectioned pencil holders, notepads and graph paper slotted away in stacking mesh trays. A tiny, dry-needled cactus perches on the windowsill behind the desk, just catching a sliver of light from a 4-inch suspension of the wide slat blinds. A studio portrait of the four of us sits in the corner of the desk, and in front of it a shot of Julie. Not the one we used for the missing person picture that was all over the news, but one from the Grand Canyon, the last family vacation we ever took. It's a posed shot. From that trip, there are countless pictures of Jane straddling voids, her feet on two boulders, hands on hips, elbows akimbo. Julie, who had just gone through a growth spurt and seemed unsure how long her limbs were, kept slipping as we climbed the rocks and stayed well away from the edge. In the photo, she's perched uncertainly on a rock, one foot up in front of her, elbow on knee, chin in hand. After a moment, I move the mouse and am relieved to see the monitor come to life with no password prompt. The desktop photo is a landscape, some generic tropical island at sunset, and the folders are arranged with painstaking neatness. I do a file search, typing in keywords one after the other. Julie, fund, trust, trustees, donation, reward, thinking there must be a spreadsheet somewhere, a record of incoming donations and search-related expenses, or at the very least a file with the contact information of the trustees. Nothing comes up, and I find myself wondering whether Julie's done this same search recently. If so, she couldn't have had better luck than I'm having. I open the web browser and check the history. Nothing. Which, considering she just told me she's been looking up her case on the internet, makes it look an awful lot like she cleared the browser history herself. Pushing away this thought, I start pulling out desk drawers, but encounter only the expected debris of empty mechanical pencils, rubber bands, and paper clips. A side drawer holds stacks of blank tax forms that make my head spin just to look at them. I slide them all shut as quietly as possible and tug the handle of the file drawer. Locked. Shit. Who needs computer passwords if you keep the hard copies under lock and key? These must be client files, highly confidential. Suddenly I feel certain the information on the Julie Fund is in this drawer. I think I've seen a desk key on his keychain before, but keys always come in twos. There must be a spare somewhere. I open the shallow drawer again to make sure there are no diminutive keys jumbled in with the paper clips. In a fit of inspiration, I lift up the plastic separator and peek under the molded plastic, where I find some dust at least, but no key. I open the other shallow drawers so I can rifle through them, but there's nothing to rifle through. How can anyone be expected to find anything in all this not mess? This time the noise behind me is real, and I whip around, cringing at the creaking chair. Julie has turned her face toward me, but her eyes are still closed, and after another murmur and a sigh, she goes silent again. I wonder if she's faking it. If she opened her eyes and saw me, closed them when I turned around. After a frozen moment in which my limbs go numb, anticipating her slightest movement, I decide it doesn't matter. If she's seen me, it's already too late, and I might as well get what I came for. And maybe she hasn't. Choosing to believe the latter, I rack my brain one more time for the key's hiding place. I've never been a big snooper. You'd think after Julie's disappearance I would have watched Jane like a hawk, would have flipped through her phone once she got one for her contacts and text message history, read her diary. Not that Julie's diary, which the police scoured, contained anything more interesting than track practice and homework and eyes dotted with hearts. Still, I used to think that by resisting the urge I was honoring Jane's privacy. Now I realize the urge was never there. I just didn't want to know. Jane's rebellion was healthy, proportionate. The constantly re-dyed hair, the piercings. What more could I gain by prying? I thought if I let her have her private world, if I let her slam the door and listen to her music, one day she would come out and thank me for giving her the space. Now that she's left the house, the city, the state, I realize she wanted me to pry. I remember the stack of notebooks she was carrying as she left the house this morning. Those were journals. She actually left her old journals in the house when she went to college. She left them for me to find. And now that I'm just catching up to her need for me, it's too late. And then I know where the key is, and that Tom has hidden it not just from the world at large, but specifically from me. He put it in the very last place I would look. I reach for Julie's picture, turn it around, and find the key tucked under one of the metal clamps that holds in the photo. I pull it out. I open the drawer. At the back, behind 15 inches of client files, there's an unmarked folder. I pull it out. Then I rearrange the files to hide the missing one to the best of my ability, lock the drawer, replace the key, and extract myself from the room full of Julie's warm, sleepy breath as quickly and silently as possible, taking the folder with me. I am expecting, perhaps, something thicker, a dusty file full of newspaper clippings, our correspondence with the parents' group, media, and law enforcement. Instead, I find a few forms clipped together, folded because they're larger than letter size, the bank documents for setting up the trust. I scan the top part, but it's all standard language, dense as a block of wood to me. There are appended documents, and when I unfold them, I see the notarized signature at the bottom of the fund administrator form. Alma Josefina Ruiz. I have no idea who that is, but she holds the purse strings to what I now see was an impressive $240,000 of collected donations in 2008. Who knows what's left now, but it might be enough to pay for GED classes,
or even a few years of college if she gets into a state school. I don't remember an Alma, but then I don't remember much of anything from that period. I drank a lot. I slept for days at a time. I took pills so I could sleep at night after having slept all through the day. Above all, I didn't want to know details. I wanted everything to blur, fade, go away forever. I wanted to be left alone. Now, faced for the first time with everything I blocked out quantified starkly in dollars, I finally feel how alone I have succeeded in making myself. I check the time and wonder when Tom will be getting home. He used to go to the support group for parents of missing children on Sunday evenings, but does he still, now that Julie is home? Is he allowed? What would it be like to be surrounded by the faces of those whose children are still and always missing after your own prayers have been answered? Then I remember. Ask Alma if anybody knows what hers looks like. It was the billboards. The last night I ever went to the support group with Tom, they turned on us, on me, about the billboards. "Your girl is everywhere," a woman, Connie, I think her name was, said that final evening. "I see her face every time I run out to the corner store. When was the last time you saw my girl Shauna's face? Do you even know what she looks like?" She turned from side to side, staring down the people sitting near her. "That's right. I guess you know she's black, that's about it. 14-year-old black girl probably just ran away, right? Nobody gives a shit. Ask Alma if anybody knows what hers looks like." In my memory, Alma has downcast eyes, dark lashes, hair in a tight, tucked-under French braid. The group leader said something about the importance of each focusing on our own feelings, and Connie said, "Pissed off!" And a mumble started up around the circle among the parents of kids who had been abducted in more ordinary ways. Picked up from school by an ex-husband and whisked across state lines, like Alma's daughter, or talked into driving off in an older boyfriend's truck. Kids who were too poor or too brown, too old or too badly behaved to wind up on the news night after night for weeks and months after they were gone. Julie's wide-eyed innocence, however, seemed made for TV. She was a character in a comic book crime. One of America's pink-cheeked, golden-haired daughters, stalked by a psycho and stolen at knife point from under her very own roof. That round face with the flat upper lip that made her look childish in precisely the way adult women are supposed to try to look childish, her ice-blue eyes, the limp, pale flag of her hair. I used to look at the stubby eyelashes that were dark near the roots and that vanished toward the tips and think, when this girl puts on makeup, we will all be doomed. Of course, we didn't have to wait that long. One by one, the group members' faces turned toward us with envy, even hatred. As if our worst nightmare had been orchestrated to steal the spotlight from theirs. As if we were lucky to have had our daughter stolen by a true psychopath. I say we, but I'm the mother. They stared at me, and I felt myself turn to stone. "I'm so glad we're talking about the anger we feel," the group leader said. "I'm so glad we're sharing these feelings." "She's just as dead as all of yours," I wanted to say. But instead I walked out and never came back, leaving Tom behind to give conciliatory speeches. I never asked how he got home at the end of the night. Suddenly I feel sure it was Alma who gave him a ride. Karen's 17th birthday party consisted of three people. Karen, and Melinda and Bob McGinty.
"Happy birthday,"
Melinda said, handing her a cardboard box. Melinda's iron-gray cap of hair was as smooth and prim as ever, but she wore earrings that bobbed against her turtleneck, and her large teeth were visible through a stretched-open smile. Even Bob looked pleased. Karen opened the little box. In it lay a necklace with a horse charm. The riding thing was how Karen survived public school in Red Bluff, California, a wasteland of baseball-playing thugs dating girls with faces like sour milk. Because she rode, she didn't have to take gym, and she had a social status independent of what she wore. That was fortunate, because dressed in the skirts and tights and sweaters the McGintys bought her, and some of it wasn't even bought but handed down from a niece who'd dropped out of high school 15 years ago and was roughly her size,
Karen looked awkward at best. Melinda and Bob didn't have a daughter of their own, although they'd tried, and their son hadn't been home since he was 18. Whatever it was he was off doing in New York, if he was still there, it was nothing he wanted to tell his parents about. They got a postcard every year or so, Melinda told her, adding, "So we know he's still alive," in a matter-of-fact way that suggested a lot of tears had already gone into that phrase. Karen had heard all this, or some version of it, before. She'd stopped being surprised when foster parents told her the story of why they were fostering. It happened so often, she almost always knew exactly for whom she was substituting. A child never born but longed for, begged for, and finally given up on. A dead child, a missing child, an older brother or sister who drove away on a motorcycle 40 years ago and never came back. She learned to distrust the big families, where the real siblings presented a united front against her, tolerating her in front of the parents but ignoring her behind their backs. "Don't worry about learning all our names. You won't be here long." The parents might act like they had too much love and needed to keep giving it away, but there was, of course, the money. She didn't blame them, but she wouldn't thank them either. Whatever role Karen was playing for her temporary parents, she was never interested in playing it well. She knew she was just killing time before aging out. Fostering with a family had risks, but it was usually safer than the streets. And when it got unsafe, when a father walked in on her changing and lingered a moment too long before backing out and shutting the door, when a cousin came into her room during the family barbecue, well, she had calibrated the precise moment past which she could no longer measure out her body's worth in string cheese and snack packs. At that point, she would run away, taking something small with her. Nothing valuable. She didn't want to end up in juvie. She aimed for sentiment instead. Things that wouldn't be missed for some time, but would spill tears when they were. 2 years in foster care had left her with a small collection of these trophies, including a Precious Moments figurine with an onion head and teary eyes, clutching a teddy bear whose ear had chipped off in her backpack. A souvenir thimble from Niagara Falls she had found in the drawer of a foster mom's bedside table. A finger painting, yellowed with age, Deacon, 4 years, in a preschool teacher's handwriting in the corner. She'd hesitated over the last one, remembering the sick little boy, but then she remembered what Deacon's older brother had done to her and the hard smack Deacon's mom had given her when she ratted him out. She kept it folded up in quarters, so she couldn't see the messy swipes of red and blue paint. But the McGinties were different. They gave her plenty of space, because they themselves liked a lot of space. They were both retired, but Melinda volunteered at the library every morning, as if constant pillow straightening and counter wiping were not enough of an outlet for her precision. At first, Karen thought she'd been brought in to babysit Bob during Melinda's library shifts. Each morning after Melinda drove off, Karen had waited for his perversion to emerge. But Bob only nursed his coffee for an hour or two before heading out to his wood shop to putter away the day. She'd go upstairs, close her door, and lie on her bed for hours at a time, staring up the light fixture, gripped with a suffocating feeling she couldn't understand, like a hand wrapped around her throat. It had been a long time since she'd been bored. Horse camp saved her from certain desperate acts of vandalism she was beginning to contemplate. Melinda signed her up for 8 weeks at a ranch run by an old friend of hers just down the road. Karen assumed it was a favor between friends because, although 2 months of camp sounded expensive, Melinda didn't seem to care whether she went or not.
"Bob will take you if you want to go," she said. "Or you can walk half an hour down the FM 229. That'll get you there. Starts at 10 in the morning every weekday."
Karen was noncommittal, but when the time came, after Melinda left for the library and Bob folded his paper and wandered off to the woodshop, and she saw they really weren't going to push it, she decided a walk sounded better than another morning alone with the wallpaper. Besides, she had a kind of distant curiosity about horses. As a child, she'd had fantasies of a silvery white steed, invisible to everyone but her, who galloped the horizon silently as a cloud, watching her from afar. When she first entered the stables, the sweaty, rank, shiver-skinned reality of horses made her ashamed of the fairy-tale version she'd envisioned. They frightened her, all twitching muscles and rolling eyes and hooves that hit the earth with a shudder she could feel through her sneakers.
But as a rule, Karen showed fear only when it helped minimize damage, and she could tell right away that cringing wouldn't get her anywhere with animals this powerful. Besides, the half a dozen other kids at the camp, many of whom were already accomplished riders, were years younger than her. The youngest was 9. When Karen petted the giant head of a chestnut mare on her first visit to the stables, she made sure the instructor, the 9-year-old, and anyone else watching saw that her hand didn't tremble. She went back the next day and the next, and over 8 weeks, she got pretty good at being around horses. Riding them, taking care of them, cleaning up after them. Not great, but comfortable. At the end of the summer, Melinda left the library early every day to watch her ride. And as much as being on the back of a strong, fast animal meant to Karen, watching Karen seemed to mean even more to Melinda. It was the horse charm that made Karen understand how much, though. Looking down at the flimsy charm, she thought that nobody had given one like it to Melinda, and that she must have wanted one, probably from someone in particular.
"We want to get a real one for you someday," Melinda said. "A horse, I mean. Our finances just aren't in order this year, but it'll happen sometime."
The McGintys occasionally referred to a distant, more prosperous past in which they'd owned horses, but this was the first time they'd ever mentioned buying one.
"Wow, thanks," Karen said. "You've made good grades this year," Melinda continued. "We're proud of you."
Bob nodded agreement.
"Anyway, we'd like to talk about taking the next step. We want to adopt you, Karen."
"My name isn't Karen," was the first thought that came into her mind.
"I love the necklace," is what she said. "Thank you so much."
She meant it. The charm on the thin gold chain was cheap, one side flat and the other sculpted to look three-dimensional, but the horse was running.
"You don't have to decide right now," Melinda said. "We just wanted you to know that we consider you our daughter."
What Melinda wasn't saying, but Karen heard in her words, was the concern over her aging out. Karen had listened to the stories in the group home. She thought of the Peets with a shudder. She weighed her memories of them against Melinda's long, strong face, which was more than plain, almost ugly. Strong, bitter lines cut a path from the corners of her mouth to the underside of her chin, that sun. But a smile softened her eyes to a watery gray. Karen's future with Melinda and Bob might involve horses, but it would also involve community college, a job in Red Bluff or Redding or even Sacramento. More, a baseball thug of her own. Maybe a walk down a church aisle trimmed with ribbons and fold-out bells made of tissue paper. And then one day this house with the clapboard siding and peaked roof would be hers, and she would sleep in the master suite that faced the wooded mountains and take her own children to the coast once a year. Snug as a fork in a drawer.
"This is the best birthday I've ever had," Karen said.
It was close enough to the truth, even if it wasn't really her birthday, just a random date that happened to stick. The next time she was out riding at the stables, she imagined leaning forward just a little more, urging the powerful creature to a trot, then a gallop, until it looked like the horse charm on her necklace. Leaping over the low wooden fence and cantering through pastures and woods and then up into the mountains. That was sheer fantasy, of course, another version of the silvery white steed. She didn't know how to jump, would kill herself and maybe the horse, too, trying. Horses didn't do well in mountains, and neither would she. Anyway, how far could a girl get on a horse these days? So she started thinking bus routes. It was time to head to Portland, where she'd heard there were more strip clubs per capita than in any other city in the U.S. That sounded like cash waiting to be made with no strings attached. When the time came, after Melinda left for the library and Bob folded his paper and wandered off to the woodshop, and Karen set off down her usual path, she was surprised and relieved at how natural it felt to turn in the wrong direction on FM 229 and just walk away. She'd wrapped the necklace chain twice around her ankle, and the little gold charm clicked against her ankle bone as she walked. Every 8th step or so, the charm slid into her shoe and got trapped against her skin for a second. Then it popped out with a thwack, worked its way around her ankle, and slithered down again. The rhythm was nice, like the tiny horse was galloping away, and she was riding it out of town instead of a greyhound bus.
10.
You think he's cheating? Alex Mercado says, casual but interested, like someone discussing odds in a race he's not betting on.
No, I don't know, I just...
A shadow passes the narrow, frosted window outside my office door, and I shift the phone to my other ear. There's always someone lurking around the department, even on the weekends.
You want me to find out if he's cheating?
He rephrases.
I'm happy to follow him, find out where he goes.
It'll cost you, runs the unspoken part of the sentence.
Would you just look into something, someone, for me instead?
I say, lowering my voice.
Alma Josefina Ruiz.
Basic background, he says, or follower.
Background,
I say hurriedly. She's a trustee for our donation fund, the fund administrator, actually.
Ah,
Alex says. Maybe that's why the name sounds familiar.
Shouldn't be hard to find out what's up with her.
And if she's seeing your husband?
Oh, and do you want me to keep tailing Julie? I found out where she's going.
Before I can ask, he says, still in that maddeningly offhand voice,
she goes to church.
What? What church?
The gate.
I'm speechless. The gate is the megachurch whose billboard I pass at the 610 flyover on my way to work every day. They meet in the goddamn Astrodome.
She doesn't go in, he says. She just sits in her car, your husband's car,
he corrects himself, in the parking lot.
What is she doing?
I don't know. It's a freaking compound. There's a lot going on in there. 3 Bible study groups around that time, a singles bowling league, and something called the Circle of Healing.
He sounds amused.
You never went to that church?
We never went to church at all, I say. I mean, Julie went with a friend once in a while after a sleepover, trying it out the way kids do.
I think of the televangelist's enlarged grin on the billboard.
Faith every day, not everyday faith.
I just can't imagine Julie wanting to go someplace like that. He's silent for a moment.
Did you watch the video, Anna?
Yes, I watched it. Gretchen Farber, that band in Portland, was it?
And?
And? Yes, it looks like her, maybe, but the image is so fuzzy, it's not like you can say for sure. It feels like honesty because I watched it only once in the middle of the night, with the sound off, and because I can hardly be sure of anything these days.
Cell phone video,
he concedes, but I get the uneasy feeling he's humoring me.
Not a great image.
Exactly, I say. And Portland
is not Mexico,
he finishes. There's a pause, so I go on the offensive.
May I ask why you were looking in Portland?
I wasn't, he says. I've been checking police reports filed all over around the time Julie arrived. Anything involving a woman her age, hoping something might turn up. There's a missing persons report out on this, Gretchen Farber. Not in Portland, actually, but in Seattle. It's from a couple days after Julie showed up.
After she came home.
You have to wait 3 days to file a missing persons report for an adult. Especially if it's the husband or boyfriend filing, in case it's what they call a lover's quarrel. This was filed by a boyfriend, Calvin something. Anyway, I got lucky.
Lucky, I think.
Because there's a video of her. Don't worry, I'm looking into it, calling the bars, trying to nail the ID.
He pauses and I can hear papers shuffling.
There's one other possibility I'm exploring.
You mean for identifying the imposter? I ask, attempting to sound sarcastic, but Alex doesn't skip a beat.
Charlotte Willard, he says. Same age as Julie, ran away from her home in Louisiana shortly after Julie, disappeared. Maybe it's nothing, but there's a Charlotte from 7 years ago, going by a different last name, of course, picked up in San Francisco. Spends a while in foster care and then sort of falls off the map. Switched up her name again or something.
So?
So, I'm not sure, he admits. But I think Charlotte may be Gretchen, and Gretchen may be, well, Julie.
And why would this Charlotte or Gretchen or whoever she is be posing as my daughter?
I hear my voice climbing to a higher pitch and I try to wrangle it back down unsuccessfully.
What could she possibly want?
I push the Julie Fund out of my mind, though Alex surely hasn't forgotten why I called him in the first place.
Honestly, Anna, I don't know yet. I'll let you know when I find something else.
His tact annoys me.
Say what you're thinking.